Hey guys, Sklar Brothers here with Dan Van Kirk.
Yes.
From Dumb People Town, and we've got Adam from Adam Ruins Everything. Adam Conover on the show this
Hello.
Week.
Hello!
Good time in Dumb People Town, right? I mean, you like to make people smarter. When they finish watching your show
and try to
listen to your podcast, they try and be smarter. We are going to not be focusing on those people in this episode.
No, but we are going to focus on possibly the greatest eyewitness to any one of our stories. Mulver.
The first story has one of the greatest Dumb People Town characters ever, and he didn't actually do anything wrong. Check it out.
Hey, weird adults. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible has the best audiobook performances, the largest library, and the most exclusive content, and you'll feel something when you listen. Learn more at audible.com/weirdadults, where you can get 30 days free and one free audiobook. It's awesome, and just so you know, I'm right now reading Missoula. I think it's a must read, and it's super easy to digest if you're listening to it on Audible. I'm also highly, highly, extremely beyond above recommending you read or listen to on Audible, So You've Been Publicly Shamed by John Ronson. If you are of the now, if you are living in the time that we're living, which I hope you are if you're listening to this, if not, please seek medical attention because you are in fact dead. But if you are living, you have to read So You've Been Publicly Shamed by John Ronson, and you can get it for free by going to audible.com/weirdadults. This book is such a necessary read because it's so relevant to the times we're living in, and I just think it's awesome. All right, guys, check it out, audible.com/weirdadults. Here we are. We're doing it. We're listening. We're finding out what's going on with Little Esther and Marc Maron. What did they have to say to each other? Was it cool? Was it funny? Was it interesting? Obviously. But here's the thing I need to warn you about. I am such a nervous mess wreck. Just everything in this episode. I was so scared. Okay, I've been living in LA for 3 years and I've been doing a bunch of random ass comedy shit, and this driving to his house to record this episode, I was more nervous than I have been for anything in the last 3 years. I don't know that I've done anything that crazy, but it's still like I was so scared. I literally was like, I don't want to go. I'm not going to go in. I'm just going to go home and ditch it. And obviously I didn't, because that would make me insane, which I am, but that's fine. I was so scared. I can't even begin to tell you. You'll see. I mean, I'm like a quiet little weird nerd monster in the very beginning. I mean, and when I first got to his house, he was just like, well, you'll see. I mean, you'll hear it. You won't see it because I don't have a video recorder on these podcasts, but you will hear it, and you'll hear it so well, you'll be able to see it in your imagination. But this episode is awesome. And you know, Marc Maron, I met him 3 years ago at the Comedy Store, and he really just, he like means a lot to me because I met him maybe the second week that I was doing stand-up, and he really gave me a lot of good advice and guidance, and I hadn't seen or spoken to him since that. I'd seen him like for a second, and we just said hi like one time at the Comedy Store over the last 3 years, but I had his email and I was like, yo, let's do a podcast, and we did it, and here it is. Hi everyone, it's Esther. I'm a little bit nervous, I guess. I'm a little uncomfortable. I'm also very excited. I'm sitting here with Marc Maron. Do you want to say hi?
Hi, Esther.
Hi, Marc.
Am I talking to you, or am I talking to this generalized audience?
Talk to me.
I'll talk directly to you, Esther.
Thank you. It's funny because you seem like you have very little faith in my ability to carry on this podcast.
I have not seen you in a long time. And I think the only time we've ever had a conversation was, I gave you a ride home once.
Yeah.
And I don't listen to your podcast, but I don't listen to anything. I'm very busy. So I just, you came over, you had no notebook, no equipment, no anything. You looked lost, and you showed up at my door like a lost child.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, okay, So I just was sort of like, all right, let's go to the garage.
Yeah. Oh God.
And we can use my tape recorder.
Yeah.
For your project.
Thank you.
Sure.
Well, I wouldn't expect that you're listening or like checking in on what I'm doing over like the course of 3 years, even though we met once. But, it's still, yeah, I guess I come in here and I'm like a soft-spoken, shy person, and you're very intimidating. Yeah. I mean, you're not like you, at first glance, you're intimidating, but then you're very warm and like open, and you know, I get the sense that you're like a host. Obviously you are, but you know, you make people around you feel comfortable.
Yeah. Sometimes I think that I have that with you.
Yeah.
And not everybody. I mean, some people I remain intimidating to, and I'm always surprised by that.
You're surprised by what?
That I remain intimidating to people, even when, you know, like you obviously can see through a certain amount of my bullshit in order for me to appear warm to you.
Right.
I'm not warm to everybody.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I guess I'm not either. I mean, I'm not really warm to anyone, but...
Really?
Well, I mean... Yeah, like, just there's so many people that when you're at a comedy club, so many random dudes that, like, want to just talk to you, and it's like, enough is enough. And not that I'm, like, some babe, but it's like, I'm so approachable.
Yeah.
That I just don't want to deal with that.
A friend of mine once said, my friend Lauren, who I dated a million years ago, she used to work as a bartender at a strip club. So she wasn't even a stripper. But she was just a bartender, and she quit because she said she got tired of men looking at her like she was food.
Oh, wow. What an interesting way to put it. Like you're food. Do you get that a lot? Like, because you do probably what the most successful podcast there is, or at least the most innovative and coolest one.
People like listening to it.
Yeah. Like you have that. So you have this relationship with all these fans. Well, they have this relationship with you. Do you feel like food ever? Like, cause people just know you and love you, and you don't know who they are, and they really feel like they know you, I'm assuming. That's how I feel.
Well, yeah. I mean, and they do know me to a certain degree. So I think the food analogy works better with women and sexuality. And
it
like,
does. Yeah.
But I definitely feel a lot of times when people come up to me, I know that they have a relationship, and I think it is relatively genuine. I mean, they do know me if they're listening to my show.
Mm-hmm.
My mother has to listen to my show in order to understand what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis or a week-to-week basis. So they have that, but I don't have that with them. So I try to, you know, be as gracious as possible and show up as well as I can for their expectation in that moment. But I do get a little exhausted. I think, like, I was at a comedy festival in Austin last week. And
Moon Tower?
Yeah. And the thing that gets a little gnarly is the picture taking. Like, people seem, because they have their phone, that they can interrupt you anywhere for a picture, which is, to me, that's a little intrusive. I'd rather they say hi and talk to me for 3 minutes than accost me in a store and say, like, hey, can we just do a picture? It's just a little, it gets a little weird.
Right.
But for the most part, yeah, it's not too draining. I've figured out a way to handle it.
But I'm assuming, though, when you do a show, you stay after for pictures, and that's, like, a totally different thing?
Yeah. You know, I'll sell some merch, take some pictures. I have no problem with any of that.
Yeah. I went on the road with Joe Rogan
yeah.
in January, and we stayed after and, like, took pictures with everyone for maybe 2 hours.
Yeah, you got to do it. It usually adds about, definitely there's a... Depending on the size of the venue, there's a pretty good size of people, and it's at least an hour of meet and greet. And I think it's, I like doing it, and I like, you know, people want to connect. So I like connecting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring this up. When I first met, Rogan and was hanging with him, you guys sort of had like a tiff between each other. And that's like since you guys then like went on each other's podcasts and now are friends.
He's never had me on his podcast.
Oh, I thought.
Nope. I don't, you know, he's just never invited me over. I don't think that we have a tiff anymore, but
right.
I do think that there's generally, I don't think about it on a day-to-day basis, but there does seem to be a fairly friendly detente between us.
Mm-hmm.
I got no beef with him. I had him on here. I confronted him with things that were in my mind. He denied most of them and we were okay. And then, a while after that, I tweeted something that pissed him off, and he sicked some, you know, he did his thing, and he got mad, And then we talked it out and everything's fine. We've had exchanges since then. It seems fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wouldn't say we're hanging out.
Right.
I'm not going to any fights.
Right.
Or hanging out at the compound, but I think Joe and I are okay today. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I remember I think that he had intended to have you on his podcast or something. Cause I remember there was a time where he was like, oh, we're going to do each other's podcasts. But I guess when Rogan says that, he just kind of means like whatever comes up first is what happens.
Well, I don't think necessarily there's any reason for him to assume that it'll be as fun as he might want it to be. He generally seems that, you know, when he has people on his podcast that you're going to hang out, you're going to, you know, get high and talk for a couple hours and it's going to be pretty good. I don't know if he trusts me to do that. That's my take on it is that I don't get high. Number one.
Is that something that you used to do and then you gave up with everything else?
Yeah. No, I'm just a sober guy. You know, I've been, you know, over 12 years, but so I can understand like there may be, you know, it's not, you know, he doesn't want to have a guest. It's, you know, he would think is judging him or not being high. I don't know what the protocol is over there,
right,
you know, from the get go, I might not be the best candidate to be a guest, but, I certainly like to talk to him. And it's fine the way it is.
Yeah.
But I could see in my paranoid mind that there's probably a couple reasons why he wouldn't have me over, but we're okay.
Adults are so funny.
Uh-huh. Is that what we are? I'm not sure what I just described to you was anything even resembling adult behavior.
Well, I know that's what you are an adult and that's why it's funny.
Yeah.
Like, cause that it is like it just seems like something that when you're a kid, you would never think that you're like having these adult, like cause it's not like you guys are, you know, at a war, you're friends, but you just have little, it seems like you're good friends that go back a long time that just have these like little things that.
I don't know that Joe and I were ever friends. I think that, you know, we've known each other a long time. I was around when he started. We started in the same town for the most part in Boston.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're very different kinds of guys. And, you know, and we both have, you know, minor issues with the types of guy each other is. and that's just, that's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, there's plenty of people that love Rogan that, you know, don't necessarily like me. I'm a bit of a introspective, complainy guy.
Right.
A little aggravated, not mentally, prone to happiness. I actually have a sort of hands-on problem with sort of like, hey, you know, fuck you, be, you know, you're negative. You know, I have a hard time with the disposition of dismissing negativity as if it's some sort of weird choice. So, you know, but we exist, you know, and we're different types of people, but I respect him and, you know, I think he respects me and that's fine.
Yeah.
But we go back. There's a funny thing about being a comic is that we all know each other a long time, but I have a few friends who are comics, but you know, just knowing somebody for 20 years doesn't mean you're pals.
It doesn't,
never once have we ever sat down and had a conversation outside of him sitting in this garage.
Yeah, but that's like a weird thing. Like you just kind of know each other. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't mean you're friends, but like with you, like I have, maybe not seen you in 3 years and I've only met you kind of one time, but then like I met you, hung out with you, knew who you were. And then from that, like sort of, I don't know if it's just like knowing you through Twitter and your comedy career updates. Like I feel like I know you and it seems like you sort of know who I am to some extent. You knew that I was like maybe doing a podcast with Death
Squad. I know what you're doing. I mean, I'm in the loop, kind of. I don't listen to it, but yeah, I feel familiar with you. I feel familiar with comics. You know, we're comics.
Yeah. That's like weird to me. Like, I would think that like you, I'm just like some random girl that emailed you that you met one time. Like, I wouldn't have assumed that you like knew that I was like, you know, walking along the path of comedians.
Why wouldn't I know that? We had a fairly, you know, real conversation a few years ago. It's like comedy is like, it's a giant camp.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all at this never ending, weird, sometimes sad summer camp or high school. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, like, even if you don't know somebody, you're like, I've seen you walking around the hallway.
Right. Hey,
yeah. yeah, I don't want to admit it, but I like those shoes you were wearing the other day. You know, I mean, and it goes on for 20 years.
Yeah. Wow. That's a good analogy.
Yeah. It's like, oh my God, when did he get that haircut? But, you know, as you get older, it's like, oh, really? He got cancer? You know, so it becomes a little sadder, the high school element.
Right. Guess it goes really far along. Yeah. When I first moved to LA, I was hanging at the Comedy Store and like, I was hanging with a lot of the door guys there and they had sort of brought you up and I had no idea who you were. I didn't know anything about any comedians really because I wasn't like a comedy nerd before I became a comedian. Not that you have to be a comedy nerd to know who you are. Certainly not right now.
No, I don't even think the comedy nerd existed. I think it's relatively new.
Yeah. Well, right. When I say comedy nerd, I just mean, you know, someone who's really into comedy right. And wants to know, but I don't mean like the nerdist shit.
Whatever. No, I mean, yeah. Well, you wanted to be a comedian, so you went to the Comedy Store, and then the Comedy Store people have their own mythology.
Yeah.
That's its own world.
Oh, yeah. Well, and they like, they would bring you up and, you know, really sort of worshipped and idolized you because you were a door guy there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so like, I remember, I haven't read your book, but I know that you have a book.
Yeah.
What's it called?
The Jerusalem Syndrome.
Yes. They were all like, you have to read this book. Oh my God. Like Marc Maron is so cool. And this is long before like the WTF podcast. Yeah. This is before you really like hit
right.
again. And so they were like, he talks about how he went up to the top of the Sunset Tower yeah. and they're like, it's so cool. And they're like, well, we have to go do it just to like honor Marc Maron.
They did not.
I swear to you. Yes.
They went up to the altar.
No. Well, we tried like me and two other guys that worked there. we were like hanging at the store one night and we're like, okay, we're going to go to the Sunset Tower. So we like walked down the street, down Sunset and like walked in the building and like we're trying to act extra casual so right. it like didn't work.
We're just going to the bar.
Yeah. No, yeah. I was like, oh, dad's room is upstairs, like just playing shit. Like a stupid game. And yeah. then they were like, what are you doing? And so we got kicked out. But we really wanted to like, I don't know the story of what you did, but we just wanted to like go and relive what you did because they worshipped you. And I was like, yeah.
It was a weird thing. And it happened over a series of years that when I worked at the Comedy Store, that was probably 1987 or so. And I was so fucked up on coke that, you know, I had this weird mystical universe in my head about what Hollywood was and what the Comedy Store was. Everything was like this dark magic world and everything had some sort of vague meaning. And it was, some of it was like just random mysticism that I was putting together. But I was so out of my mind at the time. I used to sit in that front patio on the store. Mm-hmm. And at the time, that place, the Sunset Tower, which it is now, I think that's what it's called, right? The Sunset Tower Hotel.
Yeah, it's the one across and down.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's been a lot of things. Oh. You know, I did a lot of research on it when I read the book, but it's actually one of the oldest apartment buildings on the Sunset Strip. And that goes back to the early 1900s. And it was a very luxury sort of apartment building that stars lived there. It's a weird old place. And there's this weird mural on the front of it that has Zeppelins and airplanes. And there's something about deco architecture that I think is sort of loaded up with mystical possibilities in Hollywood. And, you know, it goes back to like, you know, the beginning of Hollywood, the Jews that started Hollywood. I was out of my mind, but I got real hung up on that altar on top, which looks like an altar.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the time I was there, it was all gutted because they were rebuilding it. So the structure was gray and empty and it was completely gutted. And I just became obsessed with that altar. I thought it played into some sort of end time scenario that there was going to be a sacrifice made, and maybe Michael Jackson was going to do it. I don't know. I was a little psychotic. And years later, when I got the job on Comedy Central doing a short attention span theater, I was flown out to do some sort of press junket, like an upfront thing for cable, like, you know, to represent the show.
Uh-huh. So and you're living in New York and you're flown out here.
That was 89 or 92. So that's like, you know, 5 years after. I'd gotten most of my mind back, but not quite, you know. And they flew me out here and they put me up at that hotel. And every time for years, every time I came back to California, that same weird mystical energy or vibe that I had in my mind previous would sort of come back. It took a long time to shake that. You know, cocaine psychosis is powerful, but it was in my brain. My brain was saturated with this vibe that LA had in my mind. And at that time it had not gone away yet. And so I go out there and they put me up in that hotel for this junket. And I'm like, I've got to get some closure on this, you know? So I'm staying in the hotel And I'm like, I got to go up to that altar. I've just got to go up there. You know, and it's like late at night and I'm staying in the hotel. So I just went into a stairwell and I figured I'd get roof access. So I walked upstairs and I went out there and I was right under this thing that had all this weird energy to me at some other point in my life. And it was really windy and weird and the sky was kind of weird and electric and I was all fucked up in the head because it all came back. And I was just like, all right, I'm here. I don't know what to do here, but it's important that I'm here. And I went back down into my room and at 4:30 that morning, that earthquake hit, like that huge earthquake that, in 92, I guess it was. And, you know, the whole building was shaking and I woke up and I'm like, what is happening? There's all these weird layers of sound. You could hear like things in the room falling down and, you know, pictures on the wall. And then you could actually feel the earth kind of shifting, like the layers of sound in an earthquake in a structure are pretty fascinating because the building is making noises and the earth itself is making noises. And I was like, fuck, I don't know. I guess I should get out of here. I better get outside.
Uh-huh.
And I went outside. And that was that in the morning after I did that. I don't think they're connected, but it was sort of bizarre to me. And I just remember, you know, standing out in front of the, that Sunset Tower and yeah, everything was all the electricity was out. You could see power stations popping in the distance and like, you know, it was pretty fucked. And, we all huddled around this Lexus because we wanted to hear the radio. Like there were a bunch of people. Someone pulled the car up and we were listening in. The funny part of that story really is that I was standing next to, I can't remember the guy's name, but he was one of the creators of Beavis and Butthead. And, cause a lot of people were there for the junket. And I just remember standing next to him and he's looking out over this, you know, earthquake. Yeah. You could just see power stations blowing up. Like the air was sort of filled with sparks and shit. Cause you know, the places where all the wires meet, they kind of blow up in an earthquake. And it was just quiet and, you know, nothing was going on in the street. And, the guy who I wish I could remember his name, the guy who, one of the creators of Beavis and Butthead, he looks at me and goes, I can't. Oh, he's actually just looking out over the hills of Hollywood saying, I can't help but think this is somehow my fault.
Wow.
And here I was sitting there thinking like, I don't know, it might have something to me.
Yeah. It's
I was like, up at the altar last night. I might have kicked something into motion there.
Right. It's like totally your fault.
But that's where that came from. That chapter in the book I spent a lot of time on because I wanted to get that vibe right to sort of capture the mindset that I was in.
Yeah. Well, that's like it's funny because I didn't realize that it was the same thing, same day as the earthquake. I just thought it was like this very sentimental adventure you had at the time.
It was, but yeah. it was a mystical one. And then it became intrinsically connected to the events of the next morning. I was like, oh man, I shouldn't have got up there.
Wow. If that's not coincidental, then.
That's the sad part is, you know, I'm pretty sure I had nothing to do with it, but it did take years for me to shake that residue of psychosis. And even when I got back to LA, you know, I was not a regular at the store. I was a doorman for a little less than a year, but it was a very, weird year because, you know, Kennison was still there and, you know, I was tied up in that world and it was all very electric at the store. There was a lot of weirdness there.
Was this back when you, like, the door guys were living up in that house?
I lived in Crest Hill, yeah.
Oh, so you were only a door guy though for a year. And
right.
Then what?
Yeah, I was a door guy for a year. You know, I got out, you know, I auditioned for Mitzi and she made me a non-paid regular. And at that time, you know, the non-paid regulars were allowed to perform in the belly room and we, you know, we sort of had the run of the belly room.
Mm-hmm.
And we would basically pull people leaving out of the other two rooms up into the belly room to start a show. So like we were all assigned a night to where we could host and non-paids could go on. You know, you just sign up to be on the show in the belly room. But the way it worked then is that it was hard to pull people up there and they didn't have produced shows or anything else. It was all still in house.
Wow.
So we were sort of left to start shows at 10:30, 11. And when people would leave the main room shows, we'd be like, you want more comedy? Got some new guys. And we tried to drag them up those stairs to get shows going. And occasionally we could work in the OR, but I was never a regular. And I was living in Crest Hill. I was probably of the last crew that lived up there.
Wait, what is Crest Hill? Is that the house behind the store?
That was the house behind the store.
Okay. Why is it called that?
It was just called that.
Okay.
I don't know what, I don't actually know where that name came from.
Yeah, I've never heard that name before.
Yeah, it was Crest Hill.
But now that's just a house that Polly owns and rents out, I believe.
Does he still own it?
Yes, he owns it and just rents it out to,
right,
like, whoever.
At the time I was there, the people who were living there were the Todd, who I don't know that anyone knows anymore. No, he was a comic at the time. I think he had an aneurysm and he's gone. He's alive, but he's not here. He lived up there. Schubert lived up there when I was there. You know, I pulled him into that place. Tamayo Atsuki lived up there. And that's why Sam would come up there, because he used to date her. So he'd come up there and we'd get fucked up. And then he'd pound on her door and yell, Tamayo. Nancy Redman lived up there for a while. One of the sound guys lived up there for a while. I lived in a couple of different rooms over there. And also, but I was driving the Jeep. You know, I would run errands for Mitzi. I would take comics to the airport because they would go perform at the Comedy Store in Vegas when she had one in Vegas. So I was sort of like, you know, I lived at the store. Like I would, you know, it would just be awful, man, because we'd stay up all night getting fucked up. And then I'd have to go drive John Campanera and John Mendoza to the Burbank airport and I wouldn't fill up the Jeep. And I was just like, I was barely awake and falling asleep. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, guys. I was always late. There were some bad times. But good times. And I answered phones.
Yeah.
So I was a phone guy. I was a Jeep guy. I was a door guy.
Wow.
You know? And, yeah, so that was the way that worked. But, you know, before me, people had lived up there too. You know, Dice lived up there briefly. And, but we destroyed that place. I mean, it was just so tragic. You know, she would all of a sudden, you know, just buy shit, furniture. Like I remember she bought all this wicker furniture for the patio, you know, and at that time, you know, we would have parties up there. I mean, you know, Kennison, you know, he'd love it because it wasn't his house.
Right.
So he'd give me a bunch of money on Monday night and I'd go stock the place up and we'd be, a bunch of people would be up there and we'd be up for days on end. Eventually there was a gas fireplace in there. And, you know, it's just like when you're all coked up and like come around day two or three, you're like, let's burn that furniture. You know, so.
Oh my God.
We're fucking putting just like whole pieces of furniture into that gas fireplace. It's fucking ridiculous.
Wow. See, like, I feel like now, like that house is a nice house. That's a huge mansion, basically.
It was a weirdly laid out mansion.
Okay.
I mean, it's situated up on the hill and it's a beautiful house. And I'm sure that, you know, now it had big dining room, the big living room, and they had a kitchen. They had this weird bedroom, like right off the kitchen with its own bathroom. It was a little bedroom that had its own bathroom. It was kind of bizarre.
There's also, I don't know if that is what you're talking about, but like there's a side, like attached mini guest house. Is that what?
I think there was a basement apartment that the groundskeeper used to live in underneath. There's no side house up there, but there is I think a fully functioning apartment in the basement. But the bottom floor, there was that weird bedroom off of the kitchen. Then there's the kitchen. It's a pretty good sized kitchen. Then the dining room, which is cool. The living room was nice. Great, patio deck that overlooks the back of the store and the back and outlooks over Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And then there was a bedroom off of that, off of the living room. Then there's a foyer. And then upstairs, there's another bedroom, another two bedrooms, and then this weird other small bedroom up front that looks like it might have been a front patio or a front, like an entry room with a bathroom. It was weird.
So you guys just got to live there for free?
No. Yeah, I mean, ostensibly, if that's a word, ostensibly, we were paying rent. Like she would expect money, but yeah, that was kind of ridiculous. It was sort of like, it was like plantation money, you know?
Yeah.
she was paying you all your money and then you just sort of fold it back in. I remember paying rent vaguely, but you know, not all that often.
That's like, cause now it seems like all the comics that work there, like some of them have lived there. I'm sure you know, like know about this, but like everyone hangs out there all hours of the night when they can. There's no more house to go to part. Like that's pretty cool that you guys had that.
Well, she hated it, you know, and she didn't know what was going on there.
Yeah.
And if she, God forbid, came up to look at the way, she just kind of managed it and she always wanted to do nice things, but we were animals, you know?
Right.
But you know, we were all still living at the store. I mean, I would go down there during the day and make coffee. And I'd listen to CDs in the OR. And sometimes we'd throw a ball around in the parking lot. And, you know, back then, I mean, it was like, it was right after, you know, Don Barris used to live in the main room. Like he's asleep in his car and or he's sleeping back behind the main room. And that was before they she made it all nice. I mean, back then it was just this crappy bathroom and just this fucked up little area back there. Now it's like an apartment.
Well, I mean, it's like a strip club.
Yeah, it's like a very glitzy, hoary apartment.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, that's wow. That's so wild. Like, all there's so much like history that I forget about. Like, you were a door guy there. That no wonder all the door guys that were there when I came around were like obsessed with you because you were sort of like the one that ran away.
Yeah, I definitely, and I did. I ran away. I mean, I lost my mind and it got really too weird for me. And I left, you know, with a packed car in a panic and, you know, I split and like, I went back to New Mexico and I renewed my passport because I was pretty sure that I was being chased by something. And, I've told some of these stories before, but, you know, when I came back to LA in 2001 or 2002 and I came back to the store, it was like, the weird thing is I was never a regular.
Wait, really?
I wasn't a regular when I left LA. I was still a non-pay regular. And I went to I think it was the Aspen Comedy Festival in 1995, maybe. So that's, you know, 8 years after I left. Yeah. And I'd not gone back to the place. You know, I maybe went once to see a show and it was always just fucking weird.
Well, yeah. Did you have like a really negative relationship? Like, were you upset that you weren't a regular or were you?
Yeah. Because that's what you were working for. You just want to get your dumb name painted on that stupid wall.
Right.
And I left and it was all, you know, it was just fucked up and I ran away and, you know, a lot of shit got hung on me. You know, like I was the cause of the problems at Crest Hill or that I was somehow aiding and abetting Sam Kennison's demise. You know, I was this 21-year-old kid, you know. And I went back once to see Kennison perform with the thought of like, you know, maybe I can just say, you know, sort of say hi. And then the drug dealer came up to me and goes, yeah, maybe you should just mind your own business. And the same drug dealer who told me I should probably get out of LA, you know. But so I did. And then when I, you know, in 1995 or so, I went to the Aspen Comedy Festival. I saw Mitzi. She was there for some reason. Someone had carted her out to Aspen. And I went up to her. I said, do you remember me? Mark Maron, I was a doorman. You remember Sam and, you know, pissed on my bed and whatever. She's like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, can I work at the club? Can I be a regular? And she's like, yeah, you can be a regular. And then I was passed. So God knows if she would remember that. Mm-hmm. And then like, you know, when I came back in 2002, I still wasn't on the wall. And I don't think I would be if it weren't for Duncan Trussell, you know, because when he was booking, you know, he's like, hey, man, they're putting new names up. And I'm like, can you get my name in there? Because like, I've been sort of waiting my whole life for that. And he's like, yeah, I'll do it. So that my name didn't go up on the wall till 2002, 2003.
I'm really surprised. Like, I didn't realize, because I know that you have a very negative, or at least you did have a very negative relationship with the store. And I didn't realize that it really stemmed from not being passed when you felt like you should be.
Well, that, and I lost my mind there.
Yeah.
And I was, you know.
But do you think that you lost your mind because you wanted to be passed and couldn't get it?
No, I lost my mind because I was hanging out and doing a lot of drugs. And I created this weird power to that place. And a lot of people acknowledge the power of that place. I mean, it's not just
what
me.
Is it though? I don't, because everyone talks about that and I sort of get it and I'm sucked into it, but what is it? Like, what's the power of that place to you?
Well, I mean, it's hard to break down, but you know, there's definitely a weird energy to the place just because so much of it is really, you know, that is the place in the sense that it sits alone, you know, almost in an unkept kind of way in its mm-hmm. original structure that, you know, you sort of walk through the maze of that place and it's still Syros. It's still whatever the hell it was in the 30s. You know, it still has all of that to it. It was never kind of whitewashed over or rebuilt. So it has an almost haunted mansion feel to it just naturally.
Yeah.
And then that she insists to decorating it, you know, in black and red, you know, even when she updates shit, it's in black and red neon. And, you know, her tastes are, you know, bizarre and a little bit gothic. And it just sort of feels like it houses the ghosts of what Hollywood used to be. And it's sort of the place is its own world. So, and once when you're a kid and you get into that world and you start talking to the comics there, even when I was there and I was able to see some of them are still around, the first generation of comics that came out of there in the early 70s, you know, Mitzi was this queen and you were afraid of her. And, you know, everything about your life and career when you're a young comic there is sort of resting in her hands and you give it to her. So, you know, whatever, however we're programmed as children or comedians or whatever the hell's wrong with us, you know, we were all walking around going like, is she coming? I mean, you know, I hope she doesn't show up. You know, what if she comes in? What am I going to say to her? Like, just, you know, keeping her parking space open because I parked cars too. You know, you just had to like, you know, you were so protective of the possibility of her coming. And if she did come, you just didn't want to fuck up.
Right.
So there was just this constant fear of this woman who didn't come that often. And when she did, you know, she's wearing a feathered boa or something and she'd drive up in her, you know, or what was she driving? Like a Fiat Spider or some shit. And she'd get out and you'd just be like, oh my God, now what's going to happen? If you were working the door, you're like, you got to kick people out of her booth because, you know, you had to keep her booths open at all times in case she wanted to sit down. And then you hope that you didn't cross her in some weird way because you didn't know how she was going to process anything.
Well, at this, when you were there, was she still fully functioning?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She was, you know, she'd sit up in her office and, you know, eat her chicken salads and make the schedules. And it was just paralyzing. It was paralyzing that. You know, like if you were working the phones, you know, and then all of a sudden you had to talk to her. If you know, she had an assistant named Mike Becker, who was like her right hand man. So you usually just deal with Becker and Becker would go deal with her. But if God forbid you're on the phone and she buzzes you, you see the light from her office, you're like, oh no, she's like, yeah, it's missing. I need, and I'm like, okay, missing. You know, like it was just this constant fear of this woman who was going to tell you that you could or couldn't do comedy. I mean, that was
right.
More.
That's scary.
That was really the thing. And you never, when you lock into that place, you're not thinking like, well, I could do comedy anywhere. There was no alt rooms. There was nothing. There was, you know, there was the Laugh Factory, which was essentially at that time a hallway. It was like, you know, the size of this garage.
Yeah. Well, there's the improv.
Yeah. But that was like, you know, the Warring Camp. That was some, you know, that was for established people or people that were, you know, like clean or it had this other vibe. There was definitely this feeling like if you went over there, I remember one time when we were doormen, you talk about the ritual of like going up to the top of the Sunset Tower. Like I remember me and Schubert, we were just like, we were Comedy Store guys. And, you know, one time we like went over to the improv during the day and we did sets for each other, you know, in an empty improv just to say like, all right, we did it. We did the improv.
Wow.
And we went back without pissing anybody off. And you didn't want to piss her off by doing sets at the improv either. Whether or not it would have pissed her off or not, who the hell knows? But It had that much of a, it was like a claw on your brain. You know, the Comedy Store.
Wow. It's like a cult in like a lot of ways. But you had got there because I'm not like a historian.
Me neither.
All this, but you had got there like, was this like right after or around like when, like who had come out of the store that you were like, I want to be like, was it like Letterman? Was it like Robin Williams? Like who was like,
no, yeah, I did.
Like, what brought you there?
Nothing. I moved to Los Angeles after college. And I moved to Culver City and my writing partner from college was there. So I was hammering it out with him, you know, writing a script and that relationship eventually got ugly. So we finished the script and then I just never wanted to talk to him again. And at some point within the first month or so that I was in town, you know, I auditioned at the Comedy Store. I just was auditioning places. I went and did the open mic at the improv. I was just trying. I wanted to be a comedian. I didn't know where to start. Had no bearing on anybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody told me about anything. I just was like, I'm going to audition at the Comedy Store. I'll audition at the improv. That's what you do. So I went and signed up at the improv and I did the open mic thing. And when Howard was running that and it was just stupid, it meant nothing. And it seemed like, you know, like that goes nowhere. You know what? So I can come do another open mic in a month. I don't fucking need that. So then I went and auditioned at the Comedy Store, for Mitzi on a Monday. And, you know, I got a call in my mind, you know, sometime later. Saying that, you know, she liked you.
This is what, like your second time doing stand-up?
No. I had done some stand-up in college.
Okay.
Not much. And I'd done some stand-up, you know, one summer. I'd done some stand-up during college, you know, and I had, you know, 5 or 10 minutes of stuff. But I auditioned for her and she said, you know, you, Becker called me and said, you want a job? And I'm like, what is a comic? He's like, no, as a doorman. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'll take the job. And I went over there and it was made clear to me that you had to be a comic to be a doorman and that this was part of the process.
Right.
And I was like, all right, I'm in. And then like at that time, I got thrown out of where I was living and I was like, I was living it like that was fucking horrible, man. Like I was living with this dude and he kicked me out. So another friend of his could move in, but his mom or his uncle, you know, owned the building. So there was some chick in the building who was looking for a roommate. So I moved in there to that chick's place and I just gotten the gig at the Comedy Store. So now I was going up there and hanging out every night. And then I ended up like, you know, bringing some coke to the apartment and this chick that I was living with, you know, she had quit doing coke and then I got her to do the coke and then I ended up making out with her. And then, you know, she had a boyfriend. So then I got kicked out of that place. And then like I had nowhere to live. And I remember it was awful. I was the worst. Like I was just a fucking animal. Like she had bought all this champagne because she had, you know, a party to go to or something, or was giving it away as presents. And like one night I got to the point where I moved in this poor girl's house and within weeks, you know, she didn't want to come home because I was drinking her booze and, you know, fucking girls on the couch there. It's awful.
Oh my God.
So like eventually there was some weird intervention where her friends came and her boyfriend and were just like sat me down. Like you've got to go. So then I was at the Comedy Store and I told Becker, I'm like, I'm getting kicked out of my fucking house. You know, I don't know what the hell to do. Cause I didn't know how to look for an apartment. I didn't know how to live like a person.
Right. You know, he does at 21.
Yeah. And he's like, well, let me talk to Mitzi. Maybe you can move into the house. And I'm like, that would be very helpful. So he's like, yeah, you can move into the house. And I'm like, awesome. So
wow, you know, that seems like a really good opportunity. I don't know. Like that seems like
It was fine with me. I was like, great.
It was about to work like, out
I
well.
I didn't have to fucking worry about shit. So I just went and, you know, did what, you know, I bought my third futon or fourth futon in my life and, you know, just, you know, set it up, brought my boxes over in my car. And, you know, that's how that went. And then, yeah, I just started doing, yeah, figured out the system. I remember auditioning to be a non-paid regular. When I got the job as doorman, I had to audition for another doorman to get.
Oh my God.
It was so pathetic because like, it was like Christopher Wheel was his name. He used to do an act where he had a banjo. He played banjo and the banjo had an applause sign in it. So he occasionally could make the banjo light up and it would say applause. He was a good guy. I think he became a director, but I remember like, you know, I was the new guy on the block and I immediately became head doorman. And I thought like, well, this is good. It's already a promotion, you know, but really just no one else wants to fucking do that job because then you got to schedule the other fucking doorman, you know?
Oh my God. It's, you know, it's interesting. Like it's kind of, things are still pretty similar. I mean, it's not Mitzi making decisions anymore. It's Tommy, the talent coordinator. But like, I've never heard the term non-paid regular there. Now it's like, oh, start calling your avails in the belly room, and now you're passed in the belly room. That's like sort of what it seems would be the same thing. And then you get passed. And it's, I don't know how the decision got made for, I guess it was by what, like a showcase or an audition?
From what?
When people were getting passed, like I know when I first got to the store 3 years ago, there were still showcases for Mitzi. There would be like five comics would be scheduled for a showcase. They would do them every couple months or so, maybe every 6 months. And then she would either pass you or she wouldn't. But now I think more realistically, it's like Tommy will just make the decision and he'll be like, and he'll say, we're going to cross you over.
You know what? I got this story a little wrong.
What?
I remember what happened now.
With what?
I had auditioned at the Comedy Store, like the vague part where I guess Becker called me to give me the job as a door. I had auditioned at the Comedy Store and like I just didn't hear back and I was doing PA work on film shoots. Mm-hmm. Like I got into some circuit with that. Someone turned me, met another PA. So I did these weird, you know, jobs, you know, day jobs where you just be a PA for $100 a day or whatever. And I did a shoot for kids songs, a music video at a circus. I remember that. But then like the next assignment that the production company, like I got a gig as a PA on all these fucked up videos that Mitzi was producing. She used to, now I remember,
what?
Like I had auditioned for her and I heard nothing. Oh fuck. It's all coming back to me. Like I had heard nothing and I was fucking bummed out because I couldn't be a comic. And then I got a job on this as a PA on this shoot that she was doing these weird bunch of videos, Comedy Store. It wasn't even a TV show, but she used to own, you know, where the Hard Rock was? is
in
now
the Beverly. Oh, and on
not the Hard Rock, the House of Blues.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That she used to own that property.
Oh,
there was a restaurant there. It was an old house. It used to be one of the Barrymores, maybe Lionel Barrymore or the other one. It was an old house that she had made a restaurant called Barrymore's that no one ever ate at. So she would sell these dinner and show packages. And I always felt bad for the people that bought the dinner because no one would ever fucking eat there. There's this whole full restaurant with a bar. And I got this job being a PA on this shoot, and it was her shoot. So it was at the store and at Barrymore's. And they were shooting all these things with all the comics and all these weird sketches and bullshit. And I was working it and I'm like, fuck, this is a coincidence and this is great. So I saw Mitzi at the shoot and I was like, I went up to her and I go, I auditioned for you. Do you remember me? And she said, oh yeah, go talk to Becker and you can be a doorman. That's what happened. And that's when I got the gig.
Ha. So it was by chance, sort of.
Again. And by chance, it was kind of.
Wow.
And because years later, or not years later, but when I was working there, I remember she watched me again and she said, you're a poet. You should wear a scarf. You know, and then I was wearing a scarf for a while. But yeah, so that's how that happened. But you're saying that the system's sort of similar. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, except it's not Mitzi making calls anymore. But when I first got there, the room, I mean, it was said that it was her making those calls, mm-hmm. but the rumors were like, no, it's Tommy. But now it's clearly Tommy making all the decisions. Because when I got past, it was like, we're going to cross you over next week. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, I had the thing of like, I don't, oh, am I past now? But I don't think it has that same value as it did, obviously, when you were around. Because with you, it was Mitzi making those decisions.
But it was also like, it was the only game in town, man. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like, as a comic starting now, you can go fucking do Tiger Lily. You can do, you know, any of these, you know, comic produced shows or alt stand up rooms. I mean, when I got here, it was still really, you know, the Laugh Factory was nothing. You know, it was like, and the Improv and the Comedy Store, and that was it. Comedy Magic Club, but that was way off of my radar. And that was it. So like, in order to get stage time, you had to be doing it at a comedy club.
Well, I mean, you say these alt rooms, like you can just walk up and do them, but those are like similar, I think, to the way the Comedy Store is structured.
Oh, come on. I mean, but it's still like, it isn't, because if you're in a particular clique of comics, mm-hmm. you're making the rounds, or you have a social group that involves those comics, you know, you can get into the rotation. It's not someone, you know, sort of making these like live or die decisions. I mean,
right. That's true.
I mean, you can sort of schmooze your way. There would be weird gigs would pop up. And then there were these one nighters. You could go do Johnny Zapp.
Oh my God. I know Johnny Zapp.
Johnny Zapp used to run a string of one nighters up in the Santa Barbara area. Like, there were Johnny Zapp gigs.
I didn't even realize he ever functioned. Like, he's so.
Yeah. No, he had a room up in Solvang. You know, where I think you might have two rooms up in the Santa Barbara area where you'd go for the weekend, where, you know, you do comedy at a restaurant or whatever. And he used to run them.
And he is a comedian.
I don't know what he really was. I mean, he ran those rooms, and I remember he'd make us do improv. Like, there used to be back in the day, occasionally there'd be shows where, you know, the comics on the show would have to do improv games, which was horrendous.
Yeah.
But I remember that. I remember being really, really sick at one of his gigs with working up there with Mark Godier. But I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it wasn't just about her making decisions. It was just that the stage time was very limited to comedy clubs.
Right. And then also, I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but at that time, like, if you were regular at the store, you were getting other opportunities?
No.
No?
Like what?
Well, I don't know. Like, isn't that where people got discovered, or like all the people came?
Shit, by the time I got to the store, like, no one wants to go in there.
Already? Really?
Yeah, there were some, but
it's definitely like that now, but that's what, 20 years ago, and it was already like that.
Yeah. Oh, because you asked me who inspired me to go there. By the time I got there, most of the people had happened. You know, Robin had happened, Roseanne had happened, Jim Carrey had happened. But when I was there, the year I was there, that was the year that Dice broke. It was the year that Kennison broke. I mean, it was still, you know, when Richard Pryor was trying to put his shit back together before he got sick, he would occasionally come in. Damon Wayans would come in a lot. You know, Louis Anderson, of course. But so when I was there, it was the year of Dice and Sam. And I don't know who's really broken that big out of there since, you know, specifically those guys were store guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, occasionally, you know, industry would come in, but I had no understanding of the industry. I had no fucking understanding of anything. I remember I'd go on in the OR occasionally, and like one time a manager gave me their card and I set a meeting, but I didn't know how the business worked. I just want to be a fucking comic. You know, I was too busy staying up all night. I could barely, you know, function during the day. Like I didn't come out here with some plan.
Right.
I just want to be a fucking comedian. And that was all that I knew. So the store very quickly became my home.
Did they reach out to you for the 40th anniversary show?
They kind of did, but I was out of town. I think they wanted me to do a podcast over there, but I didn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, you know, it's like, it's still a little weird. I had Paulie in here, but I haven't put it up yet. Yeah, it's still a little weird. I'm glad that they think of me in with high regard.
They do, for sure. Especially the people that work there, which is,
A very intense time. And I think that, you know, my experience there was certainly not as long as many other people's and I certainly didn't come out of there, but it was, you know, it had a very profound and deep impact on my life. And I respect that. It was a weird fucking time, and it was a weird time for the store. And I, you know, and I'm just one of those people that, you know, I like you were saying I have familiarity with people and places very quickly. And I had a very deep relationship with that place. And I think that speaks to it more than anything else.
Yeah. Well, also, when I first got here, you said you don't think it's a good place to develop. And actually, when I first met you, you like looked at me and were like, you should not be here. That was like one of the first things you said to me. You're like, you need to go other, like, you need to get out of here. And you like made a point to show me like UCB and, you know,
it didn't have any effect.
I know. Well, it's funny because you were absolutely correct. And like, I'm sure that if I had taken your advice, I'd be like on some sitcom now. But, you know, it was too late. Like, I was already sucked in and I was like, oh, I had already absorbed the information that UCB sucked and was like for nerds. And this is like where it was cool. And so, yeah, I was already brainwashed to not want to leave there. But like you said, that's not a good place to, the store is not a good place to develop.
It creates monsters. I mean, you know, as good as the comics are, and there's a lot of great comics there, there's no doubt. But, you know, if you, the weird thing about it is that the, even now I feel it, that the store is very good at just kind of, you know, compressing people into caricatures of themselves, and the way the it's almost like the structure expects you to either be mad or be completely sort of like some sort of caricature of yourself. And this is my own sort of interpretation of it,
right?
That, you know, a lot of great hateful comedy has come out of there, and it's just weird that the people that come out of there have this weird sort of foundation of completely losing their mind and coming out the other side and finding a voice, or complete fucking clowns. And there's a lot of broken, that place is just a fucking drain that just, you know, people end up there. Like, you know, you walk, you know, if you hang out there on a Friday or Saturday, it's always been this way. There's just drifters and weirdos and broken people that gravitate to the place. And I think it's great. I'm glad those people have a warm place to hang out and even do comedy. But it's always been, you're just, in my mind, you are always fighting a sort of unseen darkness there. And if you could transcend it, then you could rock out of that place. But if you just get absorbed by it, it's tragic.
Well, how do you feel that, like, everyone says that, oh, the original room is the hardest room in the country and it's the best place to work out because you'll get better and tough. Like, do you acknowledge that at all? Or do you think that's just like a part of the myth of everything there?
No, I think that's true. And I think, not unlike, you know, the Comedy Cellar in New York, there are rooms that where you can't fucking dawdle around. And, you know, in order to stay in the saddle, you've got to stay on top of that room. And you do have to slug it out. And there's a lot to be said with learning how to slug it out. But, you know, ultimately the same thing that makes you a great comic is also can be the same thing that limits your ability to really embrace, you know, some of your creativity. Because if all you're learning is how to, you know, just deliver the jokes hard and fast, you'll be an effective comic, but are you really going to be, you know, satisfying your voice? Like I grew to realize about myself that I like things to be nuanced. You know, I don't always want, you know, a closure necessarily. I want to have a little freedom to sort of riff and improvise and also sort of open my heart up there, a little more. Whereas I think that, you know, the OR teaches you how to, you know, build a pretty good shield and just, you know, deliver the fucking goods. You know, as I evolve with comedy, it also may be the reason why I'm not a huge comic is that, you know, I like to be vulnerable on stage. I don't like to be well guarded. And I think that there's something to be said for, you know, comics that, you know, are well guarded in every situation where they just pound away no matter what, that they, you know, that's a, you know, definitely a path to success. But I didn't want to live like that.
Yeah. I mean, I never really, like, you put that very clearly to me, because you're right. There are comics, especially, like, I've seen this in interviews. I'll see people sit down on, like, the Tonight Show or wherever, and they're like doing material, or they're not themselves in an interview because they don't really know how to be themselves, because they're just like used to doing like those punchline. Whereas, yeah, when I see you, you're like yourself and you're vulnerable and it's more conversational.
Yeah, I don't know that that's really what, you know, what makes a great comic per se.
Right.
But I think that, you know, and I've said this before, I think that my personal journey as a comic was always to be myself. You know,
that's a very Comedy Store way of looking at it, though. That's like their thing. Just be yourself. That's what it says when you walk in. So there's like a sentence.
Is that,
I wonder if that's where you got
it. Under extreme pressure. If you can be yourself in this situation, then you are truly a formidable self at that.
Yeah, it's like potluck. Just about don't go up there and be funny, but just be yourself on stage for 3 minutes.
Yeah, and then feel what that pain feels like. feel that horrible feeling.
Silence and uncomfortable, yeah. But yeah, do you think that you absorbed that from the Comedy Store? Like, just be yourself, or that's just always what you wanted?
I don't think I really had an idea. Like, I don't really know what my process was. You know, it was a long, hard struggle. And, you know, I don't know that I'm... you know, necessarily a Comedy Store comic, you know, because a lot
really
of
people, there's a lot of door guys there that would be very heartbroken to hear you say that.
Well, no, I think, like, you know, my roots are there, and but like every time I go on there, it's like, oh my god, you know, I'm terrified, like I don't you know, and I'm not feeling that, you know, lately in my life. You know, I'm on the road, I'm doing hour and a half,
yeah,
and I'm like thrilled to be there. But as soon as I walk into that place and I'm sitting backstage in the main room, I'm like, oh god.
Wow.
How am I going to manage this? And, but it does, like, I do still feel like I have to succeed in those rooms, but I do find them limiting.
It's interesting that you haven't just sworn it off completely. Like, it seems to me like you've pretty much got it going on. I mean, you've got a TV show that you're working on, and you do the road and you sell out and you have an amazing podcast. Like, it seems like you would just be like, oh, like any normal sane person would be like, oh, that negative thing. And you'd cut it out and you'd never acknowledge it or go there again. But you still.
But because, like, to me, and this is, I guess, why I'm a Comedy Store comic, is that if I can do what I'm doing out in the world, like if I can be the comic I want to be in that place and it works, that's very rewarding.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But a lot of times, like, you know, there's some fucking gear I have that I've sort of like taken out, which is a survival gear. And when I feel it click back in, it bothers me.
I don't understand what you mean.
What means gear? That, like, sort of like when you go on stage in the main room or in the OR and you're sort of like, you go up there with an open heart and you're going to, you know, kind of do what you do, and that's not working. There's this other gear that is, you know, that I have where I shut something off.
Yeah.
And I fucking hammer.
Yeah.
I can do that. I don't like to do it.
Right. It's not fun.
It's not fun, but it does show you that, like, well, these jokes will work no matter what.
Yeah.
I've got jokes that I can make this place laugh with.
Yeah. I guess I would refer to that more as like survival mode. But it's the same thing. But I know that's what I go into when, like, I get really scared and things aren't going the right way.
Yeah. And I've eaten some shit. And, like, yeah, sometimes you just got to be willing to eat the shit. But I don't like to eat shit and detach. Like, if I had a choice between, like, autopiloting, mm-hmm, you know, like, I'm just going to do what I do. And if they don't like it, I'm just going to write it out. Fine. But a lot of times when you do that, some part of you shuts off.
Yeah.
And you're just sort of like, you know, all right, well, I'm just going to watch myself from the backstage area. You know, but, or I go the other way, which is like, fuck you people. Fuck this. This is bullshit. You know, I'm going to fucking bring it to you. Mm-hmm. You guys aren't going to fucking, you know, bitchify me or school me with your, you know, detachment.
Yeah.
So once I get into that mindset, then you realize like, boy, if I lived in that mindset, then I'd be a Comedy Store comic.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of comedians, they're like bomb aggressively and will have meltdowns. And it's,
I love that. Yeah. That's great. It's, you can't see that around much. Cause usually in those moments, you really find out who you are. That's where you know, that's what being yourself means.
Is yeah.
When you're on the, when you're on the original room stage going, fuck you. Fuck this. You don't, you fucking think I need this shit?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got this and this going on otherwise. Yeah. I've seen that a lot. Oh, and I've lived that. I mean, cause I got past there in January. And so I get these like 12, 15 spots and there's two Australian tourists in the crowd.
Well, sometimes that's better.
Well, why? Yeah.
Because it enables you to take the stage mm-hmm. without much risk.
Right.
And, you know, learn how to be comfortable on it.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, the theory now that I'm like being told or whatever is you do these late spots to get comfortable and then you, and like loose and relaxed on stage. And then that will carry over once you're like getting those 9:30, 10 o'clock spots.
Oh, but believe me, when I go into that place and like it all comes back on me, like, you know, I look at that schedule. I look at, you know, I know exactly what each guy is going to do to the fucking brain of the room. And, you know, I'm like, you know, like, you know, how brain fucked are these people going to be before I fucking get up there? And, you know, I don't want to be a prima donna or anything, but like, you know, I'll go up to Tommy. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, like one time, like, you know, like, you know, I'm about to go on and Polly comes in and they're about to put him on. And I'm like, and I went up to Tommy. I'm like, I'm fucking leaving. And he's like, why? It's just Polly. And I'm like, yeah, he's going to do a half hour. And I'm not there anymore. Yeah. I'm going home.
Right.
So I left.
When was this?
I don't know, a year or so ago. Okay. And I'm like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know, and then like there was another time, you know, where I don't remember what happened, but I was fucking furious. It's just sort of like I've gotten to a point where like I don't need that place.
Right.
You know,
you've said that a couple times.
But I've never needed it. Yeah, I thought, you know, it's one of these things like I don't work at improvs, you know, on the road. I won't do it.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Why?
Because I don't like them.
Why?
Why would I?
I don't know. Why wouldn't you?
Because they're big, huge rooms and they paper them and, you know, they run it like it's a goddamn corporation business and it, you know, it feels impersonal. And, you know, in a lot of them that I don't necessarily sell the number of tickets. So then I got to deal with a half room of paper. And I just don't like the way they've done business with me throughout my life. Throughout my life, you know, the improv has maybe given me 4 weeks, 5 weeks of work on off weeks. They've never been supportive of my comedy. They've never fucking helped me out in any way. They've given me shitty weeks, you know, when they've needed fill-ins. And then a few times in my career, they gave me, you know, decent weeks. But then there was that whole period of time where they were only paying everyone, no matter what level you were at, $1,500 and $200 in travel, no matter what you did or what you've done. Because there was that period where everyone was hurting for work. So what they just did is they just fucking lowballed everybody. And I thought that was reprehensible. So now, it's like the way I think about it is like, hey, I've lived this long without them.
Right.
Why do I need to go do that now?
Well,
that I can.
Is it like, it seems like, wouldn't you just think like, oh, well, now I'm a huge fucking draw. I can just go there, sell it out and just use that big.
Why would I
want
to make them the money?
I don't know. Like,
what do I owe them?
You don't owe them. I'm not saying you owe them anything,
exactly.
But I'm saying for your, sometimes what I'm learning is like, I look past flaws in other things for my own personal gain. Like, it seems like you could look past the flaw of the improv and gain something from going, right?
No.
Why not?
Why? I can just do a rock club. I can do a small theater. I can do an independently owned comedy club.
I guess I'm
that's
just
run in, like by human beings. And like the thing is with me, it's like, I'm not a huge draw. I am in some regions, you know, some areas I do well in. I'm still sort of, you know, I'm not a mainstream comic. You know, I do have a following and, you know, I can sell out in San Francisco and Seattle, Minneapolis. I'm doing real well in the clubs. But, you know, sometimes improvs are ridiculously large and sometimes they're ridiculously expensive and they're off the beaten track. And I'm still dealing
with, they're in those towns that are,
well, I'm still dealing with an intimacy level. You know, my people, You know, they know me. A lot of my fans are not necessarily comedy people. So many times I do shows and people are like, I've never been to a comedy show before. And you know, quite honestly, if I have the opportunity, I'd rather support an independently owned club.
That's pretty cool. That's a good reason right there.
And because why not?
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't owe them anything.
I guess the only why not is it seems to me from someone that has never really done the road is like, oh, the improv just seems more accessible and easier to book. Like you probably, whoever, I don't know.
They never booked me.
I meant though, like you just know about the improv and you.
Nah, bullshit. I mean, now like, you know, with your people, I mean, it's all relative to your people. It's
right,
like if
right.
I say like, you know, hey, I'm coming to like tomorrow, I'm going to Phoenix. I'm selling okay. Not great, but I've never done the club. So I'm going to tell my people. I don't know if you know about this place, but I'm going to be performing there if you want to come see me. And then they come see me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can do that anywhere.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. I guess I just don't realize there's all these other venues that you can be a comic at.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, usually where there's an improv, there's another club. You know, like in Denver, that the club, the Comedy Works is one of the oldest clubs in the world. I just started working there. And again, because of the way my career has gone, I'm just going out to some places for the first time.
Wow.
But that, you know, as nice as the improv has always been in terms of saying nice things to me, never given me much work. And now, like, maybe I can sell tickets. Like, I, you know, in Irvine, I can't sell tickets in Irvine.
Weird. It's Irvine. Isn't Irvine like a very like diverse, like, isn't that a lot of like the Mexican comedians like do well there?
Well, I think what it is, it's sort of like an outlet. Like, it's very easy for big acts to go there for one night or two nights. And cash in because it's close enough to LA to do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't do well there. And
do you ever go to the La Jolla store?
I've been there. I've been there in a long time. I don't go there very much. You know, I've been going to, I was just in Texas, Portland, you know, to Seattle, Minneapolis. I was just in New Jersey, going to, I did the South Beach. You know, I'm just doing a lot of places. I've never really, Nashville I went to recently. Madison, Wisconsin. You know, I'm going to a lot of places, but I just, it's not hostile. It's just that there's just a lot of other avenues and the performer has a lot more control than they used to because we're building our own audiences.
Right.
And if you've got a big TV show or you're a huge comic, then you just go sell out wherever you're going to go. And it's good for everybody if you make the right deal. You know, if you do, you know, I can understand that. You know, I don't begrudge anybody improvs, but I just like in my mind, they haven't given me much.
Yeah.
And you know, like in the store, like, I love the fact that I can go work there and it's really in terms of comedy clubs. It's the only one I work at when I'm in town, established comedy clubs.
So it's safe to say the Comedy Store is your home club, or does that make you uncomfortable to think?
No, that's fine. You know, in LA. Yeah. Because I don't ever put in at the improv, you know, I don't put it in the Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I'll go to the Comedy Store or I'll do alternative rooms. You know, I don't mind doing that.
What about New York? Do you have like a home base there?
Well, you know, I haven't been going back to New York a lot. You know, I do work at the Comedy Cellar, when I'm in town, if she'll give me a few spots and I stack them up. So like lately I've been doing live WTFs in Brooklyn a lot and, you know, I'll do the, you know, I like Brooklyn. I like the Union Hall shows there, but yeah, more so than not, if I'm going to perform in Manhattan, I'll generally perform at the Comedy Cellar.
Yeah. I don't know anything about New York comedy, but that's like the cool place, right?
I don't know. I mean, that's where I learned how to slug it out.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's definitely, you know, it's about joke efficiency and I definitely paid my dues in those places, slugging it out.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm happy that I don't have to fight as hard as I used to. And that, you know, my comedy, I've never been better, really. And I haven't been to the Comedy Store in months. So we'll see what happens on Saturday. I could maybe you should do a follow up on, you know, next week.
How are we on time right now?
We've done about an hour.
Okay. Should we wrap it up?
Well, what else is on your mind?
Let me think.
I feel like I just rambled on.
No, it's good. It's interesting because I have this idea of what your experience is in all this, and it's somewhat accurate, but it's also not fully accurate. And it's interesting to hear, like, I would have never known that you just only do these like small or like cool rock venue. I didn't have any idea.
I like doing independently owned comedy clubs because, you know, they're small businesses and the people, if they own one or two comedy clubs, you know, it feels like, there's a soul to the place. I don't love doing rock venues. I like doing small theaters, you know, 400-seater, 500-seaters. I've had some experience with that. But like, I go up to Portland, you know, I'll do Helium, you know, Mark Grossman's room, and he's got a room in Philly that I like as well. Mm-hmm. In Denver, you know, I love going to the Comedy Works. It's a hot club. It's great. In Madison, I'll go to Comedy on State, which is an independently owned comedy club. I'm back in at Acme in Minneapolis. And I love playing there. I sold out 5 shows there the last time I was there. I hadn't played there in 12 years. In Jersey, even though it's a scrapper of a room, but you know, Vinnie Brand, he owns, the Stress Factory. And I just did, just performed there. It was great. And he was great. And he loves his club and he's a comic as well. It's just, you know, why not go with the underdogs?
Yeah.
As opposed to the people that, you know, really tried to level comedy. And also,
yeah, that's,
you know,
bad. Like lowballing everybody, and like that's really bad. That's not okay.
I mean, it's one thing to be working at the store for $20 or $15, but you know, it's like, you know, that's the way it works there. It's an in-town spot, and you're working out.
That's just,
but you know, even the main room, you get a nice chunk of the door there if you do well. It's respectable. I just like, it's like I'm not hating on anybody. It's just been my personal experience. You know, with these clubs, like the Punchline. You know, up in San Francisco, which now is, you know, part of Live Nation, I think, but that's fine. I mean, I remember when they were, when it was just a club and it was always Bill Graham Presents, but it's a great club. And, you know, a lot of these clubs have, you know, souls and personalities. Whereas you go into the corporate run clubs and they all look kind of the same and they're all just about slamming next week's show and slamming, the drinks in a certain way.
The
paper, man, the free ticket thing is fucking death.
What do you mean?
Because if you got it, if you don't sell out, you know, and like I said, I've got my cities, but I'm still building in other cities, and you don't sell out and they give away 60 tickets. That's 60 people that don't give a fuck. And the club is going to get their drink minimum, but why do they even have to stay at the show? What's going to be their disposition? I don't know who this guy is.
Right.
Got a free ticket.
That doesn't sound fun.
Yeah, but I mean, that's business and I understand business. And like, I'm not here to make enemies. It's just like, I don't, it's like some people are, you know, now that I'm, you know, I can sell tickets in certain places. I find that, you know, some people are very nice and club owners and promoters and they're respectable and I can respect them and build a relationship with them. The improv has never been that way with me.
So what do you like want right now? Like you probably have what you want is what I would think. You basically reinvented an art form in a sense, right? Like you kind of are at the forefront of this whole podcast technology.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like lucked out in the sense that my timing was, you know, for once in my life, you know, fairly serendipitous in a positive way. And, you know, I did it the way that I evolved into doing it. You know, I didn't set out to do anything other than use this new medium in a way that
and
was interesting. But I think
yourself on it.
Right. And I think I am myself on it. And I think it is. It's helped the medium and it's inspired other comics to do it. And I'm proud of that. And I'm proud of my show. And I'm real happy with my stand up right now. I'm working on, you know, probably my 5th or 6th hour of shit, you know, and, I just put a CD out last year and I'm now doing a completely new hour for the most part. And, you know, I'm just hoping that, you know, I keep generating material and keep getting funnier because I'm a comic, you know, at heart.
What's the deal with your TV show? What can you say about it?
I've got a 10 episode, deal with IFC. I'm looking into, we're hiring a showrunner now. We're going to start writing the episodes and they're slotted for next fall. So we have a lot of time to make a great show. And I just hope, I've never had this opportunity before to actually, get TV on the air. I've had deals before where I've written scripts and stuff, but they've never made it to air.
That has to feel like kind of amazing, right? Because this is what you probably wanted for the last 10, 20 years.
I wanted to do it. I wanted to try it. You know, like you pitch a lot of shows like, you know, okay, when you're a comic and you're not a writer except for yourself, in order to, you know, if you want to have a TV show, it's got to be about you. So like, you know, you get a deal. I've had 3 deals, 4 deals in my life, but like you get a deal. And you pitch a part, you know, that the life you're living at that point in time, and you write a script that's sort of based on the life you're living at that time, and then it doesn't go. So then, you know, you got to go live some more life. Yeah. You know? So 2 or 3 years later,
right,
I'm like,
life.
Well, whatever. You know, 2 or 3 years later, I'm like, oh, this is the life I'm living now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How does this work for a TV show? And then that doesn't go, and you're like, oh fuck, I guess I got to wait another few years see if the life I'm living works out. So we're gonna, you know, we're doing a, you know, a scripted half hour, based on the life I'm living now, with the podcast and.
What would you compare it to if you had to compare it to other shows?
I don't know. You know, it's going to be a single camera feel. So, you know, there's, I guess, you know, Curb or, you know, and I imagine that anything's going to be compared to Louis, but I don't see it as that. It's just going to be me, you know, hopefully working with people that, you know, can create something around me and my personality that that represents me and also take some risks around, you know, a type of funny that, you know, perhaps I'm not, you know, necessarily known for. You know, I mean, my job for the last 20 years or 25 years has been to, yeah, a lot of effort goes into just being me. You know, that's what I do. You know, I'm pretty myopic like that. You know, I write my material for me. I talk about me and then I talk to people as me. You know, I'm not used to working in a cast. I'm not used to being on camera. I'm not used to, you know, generating stories with comedy that isn't necessarily coming from me. You know what I mean? So I just really want to, you know, get people involved that will have, you know, other points of view and things that will challenge me to do some things that maybe I've never done before. That's what I hope. Yeah. I hope that, you know, what we create is something that is different than anything else I've been doing, but yet is still uniquely mine.
Yeah. That's cool. It sounds like that's what it's going to be. I mean, that channel's really hot, you know, and it's such a good fit. And it's like, I mean, I haven't seen your pilot, but I hear really good things. And 10 episode order sounds like it's fun. Like, that's a good order.
Yeah, I'm thrilled.
You're thrilled, but it seems like you're, which is natural as an artist, like you're over that excitement and now you're just like onto what do you have to do to make it great?
Yeah, there's that, but there's also like, you know, I'm also kind of ready, you know, I don't think at any other point in my career I would have been together enough to handle it. And, you know, and I'm just, you know, I'm ready for the challenge, you know. I don't know that if I had the opportunity 10 years ago, I would have been able to do it. I'm pretty comfortable with myself and I'm, you know, sort of genuinely, you know, fearless in relation to, you know, performing and stuff. And it took like, it took 20 years for that to really happen, to really feel, you know, good about myself and about my work and not assume that I'm going to suck. You know, that those fears are sort of gone for now. And I hope they stay gone because it's sort of like nice to not be, you know, kind of driven by them.
Yeah, I was just talking about that with someone last night. Like, just if you can just decide, some comedians will like decide that being funny is all that matters, and then they'll forget about being happy. Like all that matters is that you're great on stage and being happy and having relationships and blah 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 isn't important, and that's like just how you go insane. I don't know. That's how I sometimes get. But
yeah, I at some point it's like being funny is fine. But, you know, there's also part of me that's like, you know, how much funny do you need, really? You know, and I still get, you know, sort of like, I wish I was funnier. And, you know, maybe I should do more work on this or that. But I'm pretty funny right now.
It's true. Well, yeah, thank you. I guess we can wrap it up. You're so open and honest. And it's really, that's, I think, what's such a value.
Well, thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me.
So we done?
I guess so. Are we? I know it's my podcast.
It's nice to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Thank you.
FairLaudio.com is an artist-friendly podcast collective hosted by castmates.fm. Host your own podcast at castmates.fm. Today, all of our artists reserve the rights to their materials. Your donations directly support our favorite artists, help pay for their show's production, and keep your favorite shows free. Music by The Fancy. We are thefancy.net. Visit FairLaudio.com for other original shows and learn about our community of artists that help make this collective possible. Thank you for listening to this podcast.
Want to tell you guys about a really cool thing that Randy and I have been working on, and Dan's been involved in this as well.
Yes, we're building a fort.
We are building a fort. Now, in some ways, we kind of are.
A comedy fort of sorts.
One of my favorite things that I see on social media is when someone posts a text chain between them and their mom, or them and a funny friend.
Or two comedians.
Two comedians, and you get to see the interaction back and forth, which is so fun. At times, there are text chains that we are on, the three of us, that the funniest things ever that only the three of us get to see. So we had the idea, along with a couple other people, wouldn't it be great to allow people to be a fly on the wall of these conversations that happen between funny friends of ours and funny people just back and forth to us would be really fun. And so that is sort of the germ of the idea of a special app called Banter. And we want you guys to try it and check it out. All you got to do is sign up for it. It's free. Find it in the app store. It's called Banter, B-A-N-T-E-R. Get the app. It's free. And we want you guys to check it out and just pick conversations that are between two people. And the conversations play out in real time and you get to hear it. It's curated. So nobody's going to be embarrassed.
Right.
It's the best stuff. But again, if you have a couple of minutes, you're sitting on the toilet, you're waiting for a train, you're hanging out. So when you want something, because so many times this happens to me where I want just a quick blast of something funny.
Something
and Twitter doesn't give it to me. I want to see this conversation happening between two really funny people and just get a laugh. We all need that in our day. So in order to do that, check out Banter and just download the app and let us know what you think about it.